Welcome to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Normally on this program, we dig into the week's top local news stories with reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune. Today, though, we're doing something a little bit different. On Monday, at a ceremony broadcast online from Columbia University, came this announcement.
Now, it is my privilege to announce the members of the 101st class of Pulitzer Prize winners. For reporting on the cruel treatment of sexual assault victims at Brigham Young University, the Pulitzer for local reporting goes to the Salt Lake Tribune staff.
The Salt Lake Tribune has won its second Pulitzer in the 100-year existence of the award, 150 years for the Salt Lake Tribune, by the way. And today on the show, we're going to talk with the Tribune team that led the coverage that resulted in the paper receiving this honor, the highest honor in journalism. Joining me in the studio for this conversation are Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Tribune managing editor Sheila McCann. Good morning.
Good morning.
Digital editor Rachel Piper. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also, reporter Aaron Alberti. Thanks for being here. Also, columnist now, I guess, outdoor columnist.
Thank you.
Who have we got? Also, Jessica Miller, reporter.
Hello.
And Alex Stuckey.
Hi.
Welcome to all of you, and also congratulations on receiving the Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So the award was for local reporting, and it was given to you for a series of stories having to do with sexual assault on Utah college campuses. The Pulitzer Board cited the reporting you did exposing how victims of sexual assault were treated on one college campus in particular, Brigham Young University, though the reporting series did look at how the reporting of rape is handled at other universities in Utah. And I want to get to all of that. But first, I think I'd like to ask for reflections on getting the award itself. I've seen pictures of the newsroom, the champagne, a few of you looking pretty shocked in photos. But what does getting a Pulitzer Prize mean to you, and what does it say about journalism that's being done here in our state where we live? And maybe I'll direct this question actually to managing editor Sheila McCann. To start with, Sheila, how does it feel to get the award, and what does it mean for local reporting?
It's just overwhelming to get the award. I'm not even sure I know yet. I think I have to get to the weekend and have some minutes to think about it quietly, because this whole week has just been overwhelming. Mm. I think the biggest feeling I have is gratefulness that work that was done by so many people in our newsroom, it was done very intensely by a core, but it was touched by so many people in our newsroom. To have that recognized as Pulitzer-level work is just fantastic.
Mm. Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, this award, in fact, this series of reports, it came on the heels of some tumultuous years for the Tribune and for local journalism in general, really. Are you celebrating more than just an award here?
Oh, of course. I mean, for a long time, we were in survival mode. It was not even a question of could we do this caliber of work? It was, okay, we have to dig into this because we need to put aside our fears that we're going to be extinct in a couple of months. So now that we have security, we have the financial backing of the Huntsman family, and in particular, our owner and publisher, Paul Huntsman, it's just renewed vitality within the newsroom. And this work continues, which is terrific. I mean, it's great for the community. It's great honor for us. And I don't think that anyone here would ever have done this just for the award. It's really a passion on the work.
You know, I played that clip from the Pulitzer announcement. A question I have is, were you all watching it when it happened, or was there like a designated watcher? How did it play out? Yeah, sure. Go ahead. No. Rachel Piper.
Sorry, I was just moving this otherwise. But I was not watching. Sheila and I kind of were had put the package together and entered it and everything. And that's something a lot of newsrooms do. We'll just try this for a Pulitzer this year. And then, you know, the ceremony comes and it goes to the New York Times. It goes to these huge packages, these earth-shattering investigations. And, you know, we saw a lot of impact from our story, and that was, you know, that would have been more than enough. I think that would have been more than enough for most of us, all of us.
Yeah.
And then to have the Pulitzer as well was just sort of like, that's crazy. So I didn't watch. I think a lot of people in the newsroom were watching. privately. So,
yeah. We'll get to the the series of reports that led to this award. But how did it roll out across the newsroom? How did it?
So people were watching individually quietly at their desks.
Sheila McKibben.
And Mike Gorrell was talking later in the day that it was like before a big baseball game. Nobody in the morning news huddle had breathed a word that this was even happening that day. So people were listening quietly at their desks. I don't think I was aware until after the fact how many people were listening quietly at their desks. But the internet speed is slightly different in the newsroom. I had started listening. I thought perhaps we had a shot at being a finalist. I did not think we were going to be a winner. So when I understood that he was only saying the winners, he wasn't going to be saying the finalists, I thought, well, I'll have to listen to all these winners and then look for a press release to see if we were maybe a finalist. So I kind of stopped listening. Hmm. And so in the back of my, I was still had headphones on, and so I thought I heard him say something about sex abuse or sex assault. And as my brain was kind of trying to process, wait, what did he just say? I heard people on the other side of the newsroom start to scream. And then it was kind of a rolling reaction as everybody else's internet caught up. So it was funny.
How soon did all of the rest of you find out that this had happened? Erin Alberti, for example, were you watching or were you?
No, I wasn't watching. I could hear somebody close to me. I think Sean Means was watching across from my desk. And I was almost a little irritated with people for watching because I was like, oh, God, like, we're not going to win. And then everyone's going to be disappointed, and that's what the day is going to be about. And we had these stories that I thought did some real good in the community. And why are we setting ourselves up for this disappointment? And so when I first heard somebody yelp, I thought maybe somebody had dropped something or fallen. Because I was focused on doing a hike of the week
right.
for the outdoors page. So I just was like, But then I heard some other people yelping and somebody yell, all right. And then I thought, whoa, like, I think something's afoot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was surreal.
And how about Jessica Miller, Alex Stuckey, how about you guys?
Well, I had no idea they'd been doing the announcements. I was over at the Matheson Courthouse, just working, covering a court case. And I was at lunch, and Erin called me, and I was like, oh, this is weird that Erin's calling me because she's an outdoors reporter. Why would she be calling me in the middle of the day? And
did it dawn on you then? And this is Jessica Miller.
No. Like, she called me, and she's kind of starts like crying a little bit, and she's like, Jessica, and I'm like, oh God, did she fall like while she was hiking or something? Like, and she could only find my phone number. Like, what? Is she okay? And she's like, we won a Pulitzer. And I was just like, couldn't believe it. I was at the Robin's Nest on Main Street, and it was like, everyone's just like wants to get their sandwiches, and I'm just like, I need to sit down. Like, I'm like shaking. Like, I couldn't even believe it.
Wow. And Alex Stuckey, yourself.
I was listening for some reason. I like woke up that morning. I was like, I feel really nervous. Like, I forgot to do something at work. Like, and I didn't even realize that, you know, the announcement was that day really. And then I was like, maybe it's this. But that feels weird. So I just started listening. And like Sheila said, you know, the internet was moving at such like a weird speed for everyone. So like I'm like listening. They take forever to get to local reporting. And like right before us, they announced the West Virginia one, I think. And like I hear Matt Canham start like screaming. And I was like, why does he care about West Virginia? Maybe he knows this guy. And then I heard the BYU. And I was like, oh.
Mom.
So...
Well, again, congratulations to all of you on this award, and I want to actually turn now to where this began, which is, I think about a year ago, you started breaking stories. Victims of sexual assault broke their silence. The germ for all of this, if I'm understanding correctly, was a story that Erin Alberti began working on in the spring of last year. And Erin, it kind of starts with a young woman named Maddie Barney and some statements that she made at a campus forum on sexual assault about a year, a little bit ago, correct?
Yeah. I had been looking for some time into the possibility that crime victims would be subject to discipline under BYU's honor code. It's something that had come up in a lawsuit, but it was filed pro se. The plaintiffs kind of dropped off the face of the earth after a couple of interviews. I talked to some other people who were talking speculatively about it, but I had a really hard time finding anybody who had reported being sexually assaulted or really any other kind of crime and then either faced honor code discipline or investigation, or this had happened and they hadn't reported it because they were afraid of it.
Well, explain what it is that you're describing, because essentially it's that information is getting passed from one. I mean, for people who haven't read this series, which hopefully you can go check it out at sltrip.com. But there's you can click on the Pulitzer Prize-winning link at the top of the page. But essentially, information was going from victims of sexual assault into the office at BYU that investigates honor code violations, and the honor code being this code of conduct at BYU.
Yeah, the code of conduct at BYU is relatively strict. I mean, among college honor codes, it forbids drinking alcohol, coffee, tea, illicit drug use, of course. There's a dress code. There's a curfew for when men and women can be in each other's homes. Men and women aren't allowed in each other's bedrooms. There's a lot of different provisions to the honor code. Oh, and importantly, a ban on homosexual behavior is how it's termed in the actual honor code. And that information about these other conduct issues that aren't criminal getting to the school, it was happening in sort of different channels, which I think we can probably speak to later. That's pretty complicated. But
sure.
In the student's case, who spoke up, her name is Maddie Barney. She went to a campus rape forum a year ago for Rape Awareness, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and confronted the Title IX director at the school in the forum, said that she had been disciplined as a result of reporting a rape, and how could they answer to that? We talked to a number of students who were at the forum who reported that Title IX coordinator, whose name is Sarah Westerberg, replied that she was aware of a chilling effect because of the honor code, but said that we do not apologize for the honor code.
Okay. So essentially, despite the fact that it was preventing people from reporting sexual assault, they still stood behind that policy at that time. And I want to get to the changes that have happened at BYU since and elsewhere as a result of, or at least in part as a result of the reporting that you guys did. But how about the next step? How did you then, and maybe Sheila McCann, this is a question for you, how did the decision to pursue that story as vigorously as the Tribune did play out, and how did this story grow from there?
Well, we did the first story, and then we had a follow-up story that took these issues right into the legal system. We knew we had a prosecutor speak out and say that BYU's refusal to put a pause on that process was hampering his rape prosecution. That just those two stories started to get such response, and then we were understanding that this was a story our community wanted to tell. So many people were wanting to talk to us. Aaron was finding a lot more people willing to talk to us. We also have a partnership with American Public Media that allowed us to put out what we call PinQuery, the Utah Public Insight Network, and invite people to share our stories with us. And we had so many people respond in such moving ways. And so many people were willing to speak with us. It was just clear that this is a story that people wanted us to tell and wanted to help us tell. And Aaron should probably speak to this too.
And I can add, I mean, just in terms of seeing how many people were interested in this and very willing to talk about this, Maddie Barney made that statement at a campus forum on, I think it was a Thursday night. Friday afternoon, I heard about it. And by 3 days later, by Monday night, I had done interviews with 12 people who had reported being sexually assaulted at BYU. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, it became very easy to find people who could speak to this experience. And it just kind of mushroomed from there. Our first story featured four, I think, current and former students. And a lot of people responded to that, and it just became much easier to find people to get a better feel for what was happening.
You mentioned the Utah Public Insight Network. What did you ask people to respond to?
Rachel actually wrote it, so let's have her.
Yeah, sure. Rachel Piper.
Basically asked if you were assaulted at Brigham Young University, if you reported, who you reported to, whether that was police, someone at the school, a friend, or no one. And I think we got about 60 responses total, and the vast majority of respondents had never reported, never even in some cases reported to a trusted friend or a family member because of the fear that they had that this would be seen as a blight on their own character.
Hmm. How did the story expand from there? I mean, you had a number of victims coming forward, and that obviously was a part of this, but how early did you know that there was something much bigger going on than just one person stepping forward? And again, I guess these four, you had 12 people you interviewed early on, Aaron. I don't know. And then how did that story expand into other universities? Because you did begin pursuing other university policies on how sexual assault was handled and specific cases. Sheila McCann.
We did. And that first night, the story we did the first night, we were struggling to understand Title IX, to translate Title IX. And we felt if we're having trouble, we're used to taking pretty obscure documents and translating from them for the public and helping them understand. If we're struggling with this, students must be struggling with this. So one thing I think we really wanted to pursue is, how is this whole system working for all college students? We were looking very intensely at BYU, but we felt like there would be other stories to tell. So we started writing about Title IX. We started looking at other universities. As part of writing about Title IX and how the system works at different schools, it can be very different at different schools. A student told Alex Stuckey that she had been raped, sexually assaulted by a student at USU, and that student believed that that student had assaulted other people as well. So Alex requested the police reports and found that, in fact, in 2015, four women had come forward to the Logan Police Department saying they'd been sexually assaulted by the same student.
And you know what, Alex, I'm going to have you hold that. I do want to get to that story, and it's a story that is playing out in the news right now, as a matter of fact. But I think that we need to take a quick break here. Again, we're speaking with some of the key members of the Salt Lake Tribune staff who were involved in the series of stories that led to the paper winning this year's Pulitzer Prize for local reporting. And congratulations to all of you once again. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more from Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Sheila McCann, Aaron Alberti, Alex Stuckey, Rachel Piper, and Jessica Miller after this break. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This show is normally a recap of the week's news with reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune, and you can join us every Friday at 9 a.m. for that, by the way. But today, we are doing something a little bit different. We're looking at the Tribune's groundbreaking investigation of sexual assault at Utah colleges that resulted in the paper winning a Pulitzer Prize. And it's an honor to have in studio with me some of the reporters and editors behind that story. Again, we're joined by Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor, Sheila McCann, who is managing editor, Aaron Alberti, who is now actually an outdoor columnist but worked before covering public safety, health, education, and environment editor Rachel Piper is here as well, as our reporters Alex Stuckey and Jessica Miller. And really, again, the reporting team is the core group behind this Pulitzer Award. And I'm sure that, of course, everybody at the Salt Lake Tribune had a hand in it, but congratulations to all of you once again. I'm going to invite listeners, actually, to participate in this conversation. You can call in with your own congratulations or your questions and comments for this crew. The number to call is 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can also put your comments at sltrib.com on the Behind the Headlines page. So when we went to the break, we were just going to go to Alex Stuckey to hear about the case that unraveled or that began to become apparent at Utah State University. And Alex, I'll just let you tell the story. How did this come into existence? How did you become aware of it?
Well, so like Sheila was saying, I was looking into how all of the different schools handle Title IX because they all go about it differently. And one of the women that we interviewed as part of that told me about how she had been assaulted by another student, actually a football player. And she said, you know, I think there were more. So I requested police reports for his entire time at school. He had graduated by that time. This was in May, I think. And I got four police reports back from 2015.
All involving the same student?
Yes.
I mean, football player. Okay.
Yes. You know, we just sort of started digging into it, reaching out to the alleged victims. And, you know, the police had only sent two of the four to prosecutors, and the other ones, they hadn't even talked to this football player. And three of the girls were students. And after speaking with them, you know, they told me that they had spoken to someone at the school who should have informed people, like the Title IX office, about it. So,
and you published a story on this, I guess, probably in May of last year?
No, it was in July. Okay. I got the police reports in May, but it was a sure. lot of work. So, yeah.
But that led to, I mean, that initial reporting led to them, to police in Logan opening or reopening, I guess, an investigation into this.
Yeah, that was, I don't know, a couple of days after they said they were going to start looking into this. And then, you know, we learned later that more women were coming forward. That had never reported before, you know, for various reasons, because they didn't, you know, want to ruin this guy's career or, you know, they were worried about retaliation or whatever. And so in October, they filed charges, five of them. And then in November, they filed, well, not five charges, five it charges in, yes, in five cases. And then they added two more women to that in November.
And this is, again, obviously the case against Tory Greene that is, I think, still playing out in the courts. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you're covering that right now, I'm sure.
Yes.
Where does that case stand?
Well, they had preliminary hearings in all seven women's cases 2 weeks ago. And next week, they are going. The judge is going to decide whether there's probable cause to go to trial. So,
this is a question, Alex. I think for you first, but really for the whole team here. What kind of roadblocks have you hit in trying to get information from, say, universities or police or others while doing this reporting? I'm thinking about the fact that journalists aren't just doing interviews and, you know, reporting based on interviews anymore. They're doing public information requests from the state. They're involved in lawsuits. You've got to go to court. You've got to have the backing of your organization to do that. You've got to have the backing of the Salt Lake Tribune, and it's a great thing to have both for the reporter and also for the reading public. But roadblocks, obstacles, what kind of obstacles have you run up against in this series in particular, Alex?
Well, I mean, what's, you know, really important, I think, in this particular story is, you know, what the school did or didn't do in terms of, you know, we know that these three of these women have told us that they told someone at the school that it should have run up the ladder, basically. And it doesn't appear that the school really investigated these cases against the student. So we have been trying for months to get more information about what the school knew. And so we actually have litigation right now trying to get, after that first story ran, they said that they were going to do an inquiry into what happened. They have since said that they fell short in responding to the reports against Tory Greene, but they won't tell us how, and they aren't letting us have this inquiry that they did. So that's what the litigation is about, just trying to get that information. So,
yeah, actually, you know what? I want to direct that same question to others, but we do have a caller on the line who has a question for the panel, and you will need headphones to hear this, all of you, so I will encourage you to put those on and bring in Glenn from Roosevelt, who has a question for the reporting team here that won the Pulitzer Prize. Glenn, go ahead.
How are you doing, by the way?
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning.
Yes. Congratulations. My question was, I was wondering that it took, like, it's a well-represented group of women there, very well-represented. And my big question was, we know this problem's been going on for a long time. Could it be that maybe this issue's been suppressed for a while and it took females advocating maybe for females to some degree to bring this up, because it just seems like this issue hasn't just started last year. And I guess that's my basic question.
Great. Thank you, Glenn.
I feel like there might have been a conspiracy.
Glenn, thank you very much for your question there. And I think the gist of it is essentially as a team, an all-female reporting team, I mean, that's the way this played out. How big of a role did that play in your ability to break these stories? And I don't know who to direct that question to. Sheila, it could be a good one for you.
Well, I think you can look at it more broadly. Did it take women advocating for women? To some extent, that begins with Maddie Barney. Maddie Barney stood up, and Madeline McDonald stood up, and their names, their photographs, were on the front page of the Salt Lake Tribune together looking at you. So in some ways, you could say it took those women advocating for women. And then when those women did that, we had so many other women talking. There's a very touching story that Rachel did about women dating back decades that were sexually assaulted. those women wanted to lend their voices, wanted to say, this is something that happened to me too. Add strength to what we were trying to report and to what women were telling us. So in some ways, I think maybe that's exactly right. It took women advocating for women.
Anybody else want to comment on that? That's fine. We can move beyond that, and hopefully Glenn, that answers Jennifer Napier Pierce.
Well, I will just say that I think that our reporters had developed a tremendous amount of trust with the people, and that's once the initial dam broke, people feel very comfortable coming with such intimate stories of injury and abuse and pain, and disclosing that to somebody who was willing to listen. So I do think that maybe maybe women are more compassionate and listening. I don't know. But there was a willingness to come forward. And I will say that there were men on this team.
Absolutely.
Who did significant contributions.
Reporters and photographers.
Absolutely.
You know, one story that shows up in the list that, and I think this kind of ties into this, but that the Pulitzer Board cited has to do with attitudes inside of the Mormon Church, inside of the Utah-based Mormon Church. It's an article that Aaron, you and religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack wrote. It has to do with concepts of virtue and who bears the responsibility of, for sexual assault, and which is quite obviously the assaulter, the person committing the crime. But maybe that's not so apparent in certain segments of the Mormon community. And this was a story that you wrote. What did this story touch on?
forgive me. It's complicated. There's obviously a very strong religious culture at BYU. The teachings that Peggy reported on, a lot of them come from the past. The church has, in its literature very clearly stated that sexual assault is not the responsibility of the victim. I think here what we saw is that there are a lot of, I guess, maybe cultural norms and some specific teachings from the past that inform this idea. A lot of the discussion of dress codes, and that's not just here, but all over the place, in terms of, are you like inciting the lusts of men and all of this? So it's, it's on you, can be contributing. I think what we saw here was sort of an intersection of maybe some cultural, like broader cultural or societal victim blaming tendencies with a very natural trauma reaction to blame yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a widely known reaction to trauma to blame yourself as a protective mechanism, because when you're feeling most vulnerable, it gives you some idea that you could prevent this from happening. And so if that's already going through a person's head and then everyone around them is reinforcing that,
compound,
it makes it very difficult to get to the next step.
The Mormon Church also obviously is the parent, the owner of Brigham Young University. Has the church did the church during any of this reporting kind of respond to any of this, to criticism of, for example, the now changing honor code, and we'll get to that, policy as it pertains to sexual assault in particular. Did the church say anything about that? And I don't know who to direct that question to either.
Yeah, the church's PR office wrote a response to two of the stories that we wrote, including that one. The church officials were unhappy because we usually deal with the PR office, wasn't contacted in connection with these stories. Our editor at the time, Terry Orme, wrote a response to that. Mm-hmm. For my part, I can say that we were contacting BYU throughout all of this. So that's kind of what we heard from them. We have spoken with them periodically for different stories since then. I'm trying to remember I can't quote verbatim what they said. I know they did respond in some depth to a story I was writing about LGBT students who were reported being sexually assaulted, and then
at BYU.
Yeah, at BYU, and then didn't tell anybody. Obviously, that's kind of an intersection of two kind of social issues that are of highlight importance in church culture right now. Mm.
They also responded to a story that Rachel did. Maybe she could talk about that.
Yeah, Sheila and Rachel Piper, go ahead.
In our reporting, we heard from a lot of women who had varying experiences with bishops. And that's something that the BYU Council pointed out later when they were recommending changes, that, you know, someone would come forward and say, I talked to my bishop, and he said, let's get you started repenting. Other bishops said, this is not your fault. Let's, you know, you should not feel guilty for this. You are pure, you know, you're free of sin in this. And I talked to some women who that their bishop was the turning point for them in their experience. You know, they didn't know that they'd been assaulted. They were struggling with guilt. And when they confided to their bishop, it was that person who said, you've been the victim of a crime, and helped them set them on a healing process. And the church responded to that story and said, you know, that exactly is what we tell our bishops to do. That is the correct response. That is what the church believes. But when you have a huge group of lay clergy, it's, you know, like Aaron said, some of those old teachings are still around, still in the culture, and it's hard when there's hundreds of people, thousands of bishops across the state. You might get one who's following those teachings, you might not.
Okay, so while the church itself may be clear on the issue, how it plays out among the lay clergy is not uniform. We're getting close to having to take another break here, but I did want to get back to some of those barriers that you guys may have come up against. And Alex brought it up at Utah State University. I'm thinking actually maybe we can dig into the BYU part of the story just a little bit longer, because we talked about the sharing of information between we talked about the Honor Code Office receiving information on sexual assaults from various avenues, one of them being the Title IX office at the school, one of them being another source, which was police at Brigham Young University. Is that correct?
Right, yeah. We found...
this is Jessica Miller, by the way.
Hello. we found, with at least in Maddie Barney's case, we had some documents that showed that someone from the Honor Code contacted a lieutenant with the Brigham Young police and had asked, can you go into, or can you find out some information about this case for me? And so this lieutenant went into this countywide database and looked at a Provo police record, looked at Maddie's record, looked at all these documents, and then relayed some of that intimate detail back to the Honor Code office. So we've been trying to figure out if that is happening more frequently, if this is something that's a regular thing that happens between the Honor Code Office and BYU Police. But shortly after we kind of started filing those records requests, things like that, the Department of Public Safety opened an investigation looking into that. So because of that, we can't get very many documents. They're all kind of like sealed up until that investigation's done.
Is that... you probably can't answer this question, and I don't know who can, but did that investigation come as a result of the fact that you were looking into this?
Well, it was just something that like, as we were looking through Maddie's case, you know, we were looking a lot into, like, the different court documents and the way she was treated, and there were so many different things that were going on. There was that, and then, you know, the Honor Code also found out about her case because a friend of the defendant, who happened to be a sheriff's deputy, gave the Honor Code that information. So there were a lot of different things that we were looking into about how the Honor Code was kind of entrenched with Maddie's story and her case and the different avenues that they were finding out about her case.
How about the Title IX office at BYU? And maybe we should explain what the purpose of Title IX coordinators at any university is, and then explain how information was getting from Title IX to the Honor Code Office at BYU. And Aaron Alberti, I'm looking to you on this one.
So the Title IX office is tasked with the responsibility of managing reports of gender-based violence, basically, including sexual violence. And in many schools, it's sort of the conduit for services that the school would offer, whether that's counseling or helping a student kind of rearrange their class schedule if what's going on prevents them from like taking a test or something. That's what that's where Title IX figures into this. Any school that receives federal funding
has this.
Yeah, has this. So what we found was that the Title IX office, I'll look at the case of Madeline McDonald, for example. She
survivor of sexual assault. Okay.
Yeah, at BYU, she had reported an assault, and she had gone to Title IX directly. She had later requested her records, and though she wasn't allowed to make copies, reported that she found that the honor code office file on her was opened on the same day she made the report to Title IX. The school said that they were sharing software. They were also sharing a building, and we talked to multiple students who said that employees of the Title IX office told them that an honor code investigation was like pro forma for a sexual assault report.
Okay, so you would just open it on the same day.
Yeah, and these were cases where the only student involved was the one reporting being assaulted. These weren't honor code investigations into students accused of assault.
Okay. I want to continue with that story and actually want to come to the changes that have come about because of the reporting that you've done. But first, we do need to take a quick break. A reminder to listeners that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And today we are talking about the groundbreaking investigation of sexual assault at Utah college campuses, a series of reports that won the paper a Pulitzer Prize. We've got to take another quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Sheila McCann, Aaron Alberti, Rachel Piper, Alex Stuckey, and Jessica Miller, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. This is the reporting team being the core group behind the Salt Lake Tribune's Pulitzer Prize for local reporting, something that was announced on Monday of this week. And actually, before I turn to other topics, while I'm thinking of it, is there an awards ceremony that is planned, or how does the prize get handed out to you guys?
I actually don't know. Well, we haven't heard anything from the Pulitzer Prize Committee or whoever they are. I've inquired. I'll let you know next week.
Okay. All right. Jennifer prepares. Well, I do want to talk about the changes that have come about as a result of this reporting. And some of them were immediate. For instance, the reopening of the case of Torrey Greene at Utah State University. Others weren't so immediate. And maybe we can look again at those honor code office investigations into sexual assault victims at Brigham Young University. What changes have happened at BYU because of their own initiative, but also, I would say, and because of the reporting that the Salt Lake Tribune has done? And Jessica Miller, go ahead.
Well, after... So we did these stories in May, and a couple months later, I believe, they formed an advisory committee that studied this issue. And then in October, they released this report. There was 23, I think we called them sweeping changes that they were making. And the big one was amnesty for someone who came in to report a sexual assault. If they're reporting a sexual assault, that they're not going to get in trouble with the honor code for breaking curfew, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that was a big one. A lot of it was just physically separating the Title IX office from the Honor Code office, because some students were getting confused, like, where am I? Am I in the Title IX office or am I in the Honor Code office? Apparently that wasn't a very clear distinction. So they physically moved them into separate places. I think they got like new software program to kind of separate that. Sarah Westerberg, she's still a dean at the college or at the university, but she's no longer the Title IX coordinator. They hired someone new for that. And then they just made a couple more other changes I can't really remember right now.
Sure. Jessica Miller, I'm curious about the policing side of things, that information that was being shared between mm-hmm. Between agencies or from police to the Honor Code office. Has that been stopped?
I don't know.
Do we know?
Yeah. No. Okay. You know, the Department of Public Safety investigation that was looking into those record sharing if they were doing this record sharing, they started that investigation last May, and as of last week, it's still an ongoing investigation. So they've been very tight-lipped about what they've been doing. All they've really said is, yes, it's still ongoing. No, we have no timeline for when it might be done. So what they find, I guess we'll have to wait and see, but they've kind of like locked down all that information until that investigation's done.
Are you still seeking information? Are you still getting pushback when it comes to, you know, finding out more from universities in particular? I'm wondering about, because you did reporting on more than just BYU, more than Utah State. You looked at the University of Utah, I think others during this reporting series. How about information that's coming from them and changes at those universities as far as sexual assault investigations go? And I don't know if anybody here wants to address that. Alex Stuckey, sure.
I guess that's me. I don't know about changes per se at those other schools, but you know, University of Utah is under federal investigation for how it handles this kind of stuff. So is Westminster. You know, I'm thinking Westminster just hired a victim advocate. Mm-hmm. So there are some things changing, but I wouldn't say it's because of us. I think it's just, you know, across the country, universities are sort of realizing that they need to handle these situations better and protect students more when they come forward about these sorts of things. So
there's been a national student movement aimed at helping victims. There's been a lot of talk about sexual assault in the wake, especially of some high profile cases around the country in maybe the past 4 or 5 years, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we don't have a lot of time left, and I kind of wanted to save some time to talk a little bit about the role, because you did mention this, but the role that victims played in bringing these stories forward and how much that played into. I mean, this is an award-winning series of reporting, but it took, of course, the courage of victims for that to happen. I don't know. Does anybody want to speak to what the victims did?
Well, several of the victims reached out, like, independently or voluntarily to us. We reached out to some of the victims that we'd heard about through friends, on social media. You know, different people had different kind of levels of exposure that they were willing to accept. We had a few people who were willing to do first and last name, photo, and have their identity completely tied into the story. We had people who used their first name. We had people. We had one person in one of my stories with a pseudonym. I don't know if I can speak to yours, Alex, but
people who used pseudonyms and didn't want to be identified.
There were a couple that didn't want to be identified, or they were identified by initials. In one case, this was somebody who had actually there's a charge pending against the accused sexual assailant for a second assault on campus afterwards. That was considered retaliatory. So, we didn't put her name in the paper after all that. But the different people had sort of different levels of exposure. This was the exposing their identity became kind of important in the LGBT story because, you know, a lot of these students weren't publicly out. Mm. And so that was kind of a sensitivity there, too.
Okay. And would of course impact their sort of status at if you're talking about Brigham Young University, it would impact their ability to remain there.
Well, it depends on what the school believes they're doing.
It's on actions, not on identity in their honor
according
code.
To the honor code. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, Jennifer Napier-Pierce.
So I don't want to give anyone in the public the perception that this is advocacy journalism. These were women who came forward. We told their stories, and we sought answers from the institutions that were supposed to protect them. I mean, I think that's the driving force of all of this reporting, is asking some really tough questions of college campus administrators. And are you obeying Title IX? Are you obeying the law? In the course of events, all of these women here have become such experts in Title IX, something that I had no exposure to initially. And so I just want to put that out there. There wasn't a premeditated storyline going on here. Right. This was about asking really tough questions of law enforcement, of college administrators, and of a cultural milieu. So, that reporting continues. And even though
these women say is the truth, every story has been corroborated in some way. It wasn't just accepted blindly, like, oh, of course, they're just telling the truth because we only got one side of the story.
Sourcing. Sure. Go ahead, Erin.
Well, and I mean, I want to add, we asked tough questions of the students that were reporting this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of documentation that we were asking, the background interviews, the paperwork that they had received from the school, they were sending me text messages that were screen capped, Facebook messages showing me their computers. I mean, it's a lot of this was voluntary because they wanted to show what had happened conclusively. But yeah, we asked tough questions of them too.
Sure. I mean, for a victim, you can imagine, or you know, a survivor of sexual assault, you can imagine that being a kind of de-victimizing process. I mean, to go forward to claim that story, you still have to ask the tough questions. But for them to be empowered to tell their stories is also kind of a, in their own mind, must be cathartic. I don't know what the word is. I have no idea. I'll leave it there. Guys, we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to actually ask one final question having to do with getting the prize, and which is the Pulitzer Prize. It's the highest honor that we have here in our country for journalism. You know, did any of you ever imagine yourselves getting it? But also, does it change what you're doing now? And then another part of this is, you know, were any of you at any point considering leaving journalists? Why did you stay in the field of journalism, especially when it's had its ups and downs over the years? And I'll throw that out there to anybody who wants to answer it. And it may be nobody.
This is a little tricky with their boss sitting right here. So I will close my ears if you like.
I mean, I guess maybe I'll narrow that down. Why did you become journalists, and why did you stay in the field? And anybody want to answer that?
Because I had an English major.
What else was I going to do? We have no other skills. This is all we can do.
You know, we talked a little bit about this the day we won the award. We had a minute when we were all in what we call our Shark Tank together. And I asked everybody, what an amazing day. And when did each of you decide that you wanted to be a journalist, that was going to be it for you? And I think all of them described a falling in love with what journalism is, what journalism can accomplish. And that love, that passion has been able to overcome. Look what has happened to our industry. We've had such sad days in our newsrooms of layoffs. One of the challenges or obstacles you could say we overcame in doing this is the fact that our newsroom's smaller. We're growing again now, but at the time was smaller than it had been in I don't know how long. So having to draw on all those resources, having to sustain a focus, all of these reporters and editors kept doing other beats, kept doing their other jobs. Yeah. But that passion for story, that passion for the impact that journalism can have, I think is what keeps us in.
Sheila McCann, again, a celebration of the work that reporters do, the Pulitzer Prize also being a celebration of journalism itself. And not that long ago, there were people who were worried about the future of the Salt Lake Tribune. Today, I think many people in the community are proud of our hometown paper and its commitment to shining a light into the darkness and asking the tough questions and speaking truth to power. And again, congratulations to everybody at the Salt Lake Tribune who had a hand in this story. It's really a remarkable thing. Any final words? We've got about a minute left. Jennifer Napier Pierce, for example, any words to your team here, your Pulitzer Prize winning team?
I could not be prouder. I feel like a proud mom. Honestly, my role in this has been signing legal checks, you know, and saying, can we say that in the newspaper? Because there's been some really disturbing testimony that we had to translate into something that was palatable for a general audience. I mean, I can't take any credit other than that, but I'm just so impressed with their professionalism and with their zeal and their persistence, their acknowledgement that they will not give up when they don't get an answer, which is so gratifying. I have to say that the reporting staff is really young. So this is a very good sign for the future of the Salt Lake Tribune. We could not be happier to have this generation of reporters and see how they grow and develop over the years. I think it's tremendous for this community.
That's Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier Pierce. Guys, I'm sorry to say that the hour is up. Again, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Tribune Managing Editor Sheila McCann, Digital Editor Rachel Piper, and reporters Aaron Alberti, Jessica Miller, and Alex Stuckey. Our congratulations to you once again and everyone at the Tribune, past and present, who had a hand in this. And thanks very much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis and Emily Means here at KCPW. Also to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio. And thanks very much to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or however you get your podcasts. We're also online on Facebook at KCPWFM, and on Twitter we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great holiday weekend.